Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 23rd of August 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it is the beginning of another glorious week in Blighty, and we are here to discuss the week's news and talk about our greatest Briton for this week. And who better to discuss these sorts of subjects with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. It's an interesting time in which we're living. I think that there are some big changes taking place. I think that the repercussions of what's going on in Afghanistan could be quite considerable. It certainly seems as though it's galvanized the opposition to the Democrats in the United States to start campaigning now to get Biden replaced for being allegedly, and there is some evidence to sort of support that case, but allegedly senile, that's the word I was struggling for there. And so we may see a change of presidency in the United States. It may be that the reluctance of the American government to support the outgoing Afghan regime in Kabul will result in a certain amount of regime change in Washington.
Well, I don't want to see Kamala Harris actually taking the presidency. And of course, there really isn't a lot of news that's going on in Britain at the moment. All the main news is concerned with what's going on in Afghanistan. And of course, that is because we were heavily involved in Afghanistan, and our government are away on holiday at the moment, so it's a bit of a slow news week. So we will be concentrating on what's happening in Afghanistan and what that means for Britain today. Before we really get into that, I know listeners are probably now aware that I was in court last week regarding charges that were actually made a couple of years ago. I haven't spoken about them publicly, and I can't talk about the ongoing court case, but I do want to hear from Radio Albion listeners. The accusation that has been made against me is that what I say is likely to stir up hate. So what I would like to hear from you listeners is how Radio Albion makes you feel, why you listen to us, and especially if you have been inspired to take any action after listening to me in particular or any of our podcasts. And especially good is if you have been listening to us since the Radio Aryan days, and if you can comment on any changes that you might have noticed over the years. And this will be especially helpful for me if you can send that in writing to stormersubs@hushmail.com or get in touch with me on Telegram. It's very easy to do there, or you can leave a comment on Discus anywhere on the website. You could even drop into the chat room and just tell me why you listen to Radio Albion and what you get out of it and what you feel encouraged to do after listening to me speak, and that will be a great help. And that's really all that I can actually say about this, apart from that I am confident that we will beat this heinous charge against my life's work, and once it's all over, I'll be able to talk more about it with you. And thank you for your concern, and thank you for your support, and I will probably repeat this request at the end of the show just to remind people about it. But now, if we get back onto the Afghanistan thing, I mean, last week I saw the press conference, and I was very emotional watching this press conference, because the ethnocentrism that was being shown, the positive ethnocentrism, just, you know, it was really great to see. They seemed really concerned about their Afghan people. They wanted the young people to stay there. They didn't want people to leave. They didn't want creative types to leave. They said that that they wanted their women to be a part of things, and that women are important. You know, they are the future of the nation. Without the women, you wouldn't have a nation. There was lots of talk about the nation, in fact. And the positive ethnocentrism came in when they said there would be an amnesty for all those who have worked with the occupation forces, which were British and American and NATO forces. And obviously that doesn't mean there's amnesty from committing crimes. If people have committed crimes, if they've killed people or they've broken Islamic laws, then they will be held accountable. But simply just for working with the occupation forces, nobody is going to be punished. And I did I saw in the news this week there was an allegation that there had been an attack on somebody for this, and it was saying that the Taliban had broken their word, but the actual date of this attack had actually been a month ago. So we have to be careful what we're actually reading in the newspapers about this. And there are also roving bands of bandits in Afghanistan that claim to be the Taliban. So it's rather like the bad guys or dressing up as your enemy and then going out and committing heinous acts so that people think it's their enemy that actually did that. We know that sort of thing has gone on in some of the wars in the past. So you have to be careful about what you are reading. We did a podcast on this last week with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. He particularly talked about the economy, because they have their own banking system, and this is why they were such pariahs before, because their banking system couldn't be linked up with the rest of the international banking system. They also have discovered that they have lots of lithium there, which is required for making rechargeable batteries. So there is a prospect of them opening up these lithium mines and earning money for the country through that. And the Taliban are also very against poppy cultivation, and they actually eliminated all the heroin trade the last time that they were in power. And they also eliminated the child abuse, which is they refer to as Baka Bazi, which the American forces were ordered not to interfere with, along with not to interfere with the poppy fields. And of course, there was lots of corruption as well. And that's why the Afghans have basically handed their country back over to the Taliban. It's a reversal back to the natural order, and it's a reversal back to an ethno state, and actually being run by the Afghans themselves rather than being run by the puppet government. And of course the people that were trying to leave, it's dreadful to see them falling off an airplane like that, and terrible things that have been happening at the airport. But the people that are trying to leave are quite clearly the ones that have something to fear, aren't they? They are the ones that have done bad things. They're probably the ones that have been involved in the drugs trade, the ones that have been involved with the abuse of children, the ones that have been corrupt, that instead of paying the energy bills, they've been keeping the money, pocketing the money, because there's so much corruption that goes on over there. And now we have the Western governments calling to take these Afghan refugees into Britain. I was watching a talk program the other day, and people were saying, you know, why should we be doing this? Should we not be looking after the people that we already have in Britain? And of course, our governments are going to ignore that. The Conservative government promised us that they were going to cut immigration. And then since then, they've given passports to all the Hong Kongese, told them that they could come here. And now it looks like they're going to say to thousands of Afghans that they can come here. And they say it's women and children, but it didn't look like many women and children that were trying to get on that plane. And I fear it will be the criminal types, because the ethno-nationalist types, the ethnocentric types that love their people, are going to want to stay in Afghanistan, and they're going to want to rebuild it. They're going to want to rebuild their country. It's going to be the types that are just interested in materialism that are going to be wanting to actually flee the country. So that's some of my thoughts on it, Max. I know you've been thinking about it in particular with how it actually affects Britain and going forward. What are your thoughts on it all?
Well, just on the point that you just raised about the numbers of migrants or asylum seekers that are going to be coming from Afghanistan, the fact of the matter is that with the chaos that there appears to be around the airport in Kabul, it's going to be very difficult for whoever is in charge of that to actually maintain control to such a degree that they're going to be able to vet the people that they're allowing on the planes. So it would not surprise me if Al-Qaeda are still active in Afghanistan, and I would imagine that Al-Qaeda are still active in Afghanistan, that a number of Al-Qaeda operatives will come forward and claim that they will be killed if they remain there, and that they need to come to Britain. Of course, they won't announce themselves as Al-Qaeda. They'll say that they were the brothers or the cousins of somebody who was a translator for the British Army that was out there, for the American Army. And so I would imagine that the conditions that exist in Kabul airport are ideal for somebody wishing to smuggle their way into Britain as an asylum seeker. And one of the things that's particularly irritated me in the news has been the statements by various talking heads about how we owe it to these people that have been the translators for our soldiers out there. We owe it to them because they fought side by side with our troops, as if we were fighting a war for ourselves. But I thought it was our troops that were over there helping them fight a war to free their country from the Taliban and the Mujahideen. And so it would seem that the people who were fighting alongside the British forces were not fighting for us, but they were fighting for themselves. But then when they realized that we weren't going to be there forever, they decided that they didn't actually want to fight for themselves. And so they've kind of melted away into the background as the Taliban have arrived. I'm sort of reminded of a quotation from one of the speeches by Carl Pearson that we'll be dealing with a bit later on, which is National Life from the Standpoint of Science, which is a speech that he made around about 1912, I think it was. But during the course of this speech, he pointed out that the struggle for the existence among nations will not necessarily be settled in favour of the biggest nation, nor in favour of the best armed nation, nor in favour of the nation with the greatest material resources. Basically, what he points out there is that it requires a single-mindedness of purpose and sound leadership, or wise leadership, for a nation to perform at its best in a wartime situation. And it appears that the situation out in Afghanistan was far from that, in that what we had was a demonstration of the futility of trying to prop up a very unpopular regime. And the speed with which the Taliban were able to take over Afghanistan is a reflection of how unpopular the Ashraf Ghani government was. We're told that the Americans have spent something like $86 billion over the 26 years that they've been, or 20 odd years rather, that they've been out there, and that they had trained apparently 300,000 Afghan soldiers. And yet the total numbers estimated for the Taliban is only somewhere between 75 and 80,000 soldiers. And so the Taliban apparently ragtag band of hill fighters with guns that they've picked up from here and there and odd bits of ammunition and stuff that they've been able to steal were able to overcome and were able to frighten away effectively something like 300,000 troops that have been trained and armed and equipped by Western powers, which is a truly amazing thing. And what we have to sort of think about with the training of the 300,000 is how many of them were actually Afghans who wanted to defend their country against the Taliban, and how many of them were Taliban sympathisers who were just obtaining a free military training by the American and British forces while they were out there, so that when the time came for the Taliban to rise again, they would just throw off their military uniforms, put on their baggy trousers and turbans and things, and join the ranks of the Taliban. And I think that probably quite a lot of that happened. And this would account for the fact that at various points during the 20-year history of British and American involvement in Afghanistan, that there were a number of occasions where the Afghan trainee soldiers turn their guns on their trainers, and there were a number of American and I believe British soldiers that were shot in those kind of what were described as friendly fire kind of accidents, during some of which couldn't really be explained as an accident, that happened during that period. So what we've got to do is sort of ask, you know, where are all these 300,000 people that were trained? Where are they now? And one of the answers to that question has been put forward by sort of pointing out that the reasons why, you know, as part of the reasons why the Taliban won and the Afghan army didn't, was the fact that the Afghan army probably wasn't anywhere near as large as the Americans thought it was. And this is that there appears to have been, there are reports of there being such high levels of corruption amongst the Afghan army that lots of senior officers used to invent what were called ghost soldiers, which actually were just names that they made up to sort of fill the lists of recruits that they had supposedly recruited, and whose salaries were being paid by the West, so they could pocket the salaries for these ghost soldiers that didn't actually exist were being skimmed off, and so therefore the numbers of actual Afghan soldiers was considerably less than the 300,000. This is what's being alleged. But also in terms of the reasons why the Taliban took over the country so easily were the fact that the Afghan army did rely to a great extent for air cover that was provided by the Americans in order for them to be able to supply the more far-flung parts of the country. And if you think about it, you know, the photographs that you've seen or the film footage that you've seen of the Afghan countryside, it isn't exactly hospitable countryside. And it's the sort of countryside that would be ideal for somebody to ambush a supply line of trucks and things of this sort. That's not to say that none of the Afghan soldiers have fought at all, because there are some reports that some of the more elite troops, the commandos, that they did put up a fight in certain places, but largely they did just melt away. And a lot of this has been attributed to the fact that the Taliban had a unifying ideology. Their unifying ideology was their brand of Islam, or was Islam in general. That was their unifying ideology. And so, you know, as they were charging into battle, they were fired up with the belief that they were fighting on God's side and chanting Allahu Akbar, whereas on the other side, the poor recruits that were taken into the Afghan army had only had liberalism to shout in response to that. And of course, a shout of liberalism is going to sound a bit wet and flat when you're charging into battle against people who are really excited over the prospect of fighting and dying for Allah, basically, and who are looking forward to meeting their virgins in paradise.
I mean, what do you really have there? I mean, you have them understand, seeing what they were doing as a righteous cause. You've got the bonding of ethnicity there, and you've also got the bonding of the religion there. And it's going up against liberal progressive values, which were never popular. It amazes me that the hubris of the West in thinking that just because it works for us, or we think it works for us, and we think it's a good thing, that the rest of the world is going to want it as well. I mean, how many times has this happened? You know, they tried to bring democracy to Iraq. That was a failure. They tried to bring democracy to Libya. That was a failure. They tried to bring democracy to Afghanistan. That was a failure. You know, these are different peoples to us. They're not white people. They have a different way of doing things. They have a different culture. They have a different religion. They have just completely different ways of doing things to us, and it's just incredibly arrogant to think that they would, to just assume that they would want the same things that we do. I mean, we know that they're diametrically opposed to a lot of the things that we promote here in the West, and it's not going to make them want to be on our side. But putting up things like the gay pride flag on the Kabul embassy, they did that a month before this happened. And I mean, that must have just weakened the resolve of this Afghan army, thinking, well, here we are, that's what we're fighting for, lads, gay pride in a country that is strictly Islamic and that has strict Islamic punishments for homosexuality. I mean, it's basically saying to them, if you're fighting on this side, you're fighting against people that our religion says, you know, should be punished. And why are you defending them? It's you know, it must have been very demoralizing for them to see that. And yet the West thinks that this is a great thing to do. A similar thing happened in Libya, I think. They sent a homosexual over as the American diplomat in the embassy there at Libya. You remember in Benghazi when the diplomat got shot up and the embassy got destroyed? That was the reason why, because they sent this homosexual diplomat over there to a place that is very, very, very anti-homosexuals. It's just the arrogance of the West. It's just incredible. I mean, it interests me that everything is centered around the airport as well. So long as they can keep hold of the airport, then they've got, you know, they've almost got control of the country, really, because they can take planes off from there and they can, you know, they can drop bombs on the rest of the country or they can do whatever. The airport is such a powerful thing, and it connects all the countries up from the West. They can just get in a plane and within a few hours they can be in one of these other countries. It's obviously the most important part of a country is actually the airport, and they have different laws within airports as well. There was another thing I wanted to talk about here as well, which is the changing goals that they have. I mean, when we went over there, we were told we were going over there because Afghanistan had become a haven for terrorists, because we were told that Osama bin Laden and his gang of Saudi terrorists had been training in Afghanistan to take down the Twin Towers, and we needed to go over there to get rid of Osama bin Laden, even though the Taliban, once this happened, they said, well, if you want Osama bin Laden, we're quite happy to find him for you and hand him over to you so that you can interrogate him. But they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to work with the Taliban. So we were told we were going over there to stop the terrorism. And we had this war on terror that was shouted from the rooftops, basically a war on an emotion. How are you going to be able to tell when you've actually won that war when nobody is ever terrified anymore in the rest of the world? I mean, it was setting it up to be an endless war, really, calling it the war on terror. And then over the years, it's changed. And instead of being a war on terror, it's been a war to bring democracy and human rights to Afghanistan. And now what they're talking about is, you know, we should have stayed over there because of feminism, because we should have wanted to protect the girls that want to go to school and go to university and want to work somewhere instead of serving their husband and producing children. And of course, what you've got there, you've got a society that is based on rigidly based on a patriarchy, and it has to work that way because you have all these different tribes, you have all these different tribal elders, and the Taliban are made up of the tribal elders. It's the way that all societies were about 1,000 years ago, basically. And the women there are needed to perform the female roles. To then say, well, we're going to bring democracy in and people can vote. And they say, well, this person here doesn't have as much value as this person at the top of the tribe. It's what the person at the top of the tribe says that matters. And the women are there because they are that needed to bring up the children. They needed to do the mothering role. Why would you want them to be working? If they're working, they're not there with their children. And it's important that they need to bring up their children. So you have a completely different way of doing things over there, and we're trying to force this Western globalist mindset on them. And the reasons for this war have evolved over the years, and until now we're saying, well, we were there to protect feminism, and we were there to subvert the nation, basically, because you're subverting the natural order there by promoting the idea that women shouldn't become mothers and that they should have date around and maybe get divorced and maybe have more than one man, and they should be seen as equal to men rather than be seen as different to men. I mean, all these things, they weaken a nation, and the Afghans can see that, especially the Afghan males, and the natural order has basically reasserted itself, and it managed to do that through ethnocentrism. It managed to do that because they have a very, very strong sense of identity. They strongly identify as being Afghan, and they strongly identify with their religion. And these are the two things that we've lost in the West. We no longer identify with who we are. We no longer have a strict identity of British people being white people, for instance. British citizens can be of any ethnicity, so we don't have that unique identity anymore to ourselves. We have turned our backs on Christianity. I think something like 50% of the country is now Christian, and they're only nominally Christian. They don't strongly identify as Christian, nowhere near to the strength that Afghans will associate with their religion. And because of that, we've become weak in the West. And because of that, a ragtag band of hill warriors, as you call them, Max, that they're able to take on the most powerful global empire on the planet and defeat them in their sandals and their pajamas. And the reason why they did this, it's ethnocentrism. The group with the strongest ethnocentrism, positive ethnocentrism and negative ethnocentrism, is always going to be the group that wins. And all the computer simulations show that. And what we need to do in the West, we need to get back that sense of positive ethnocentrism, get back that sense of identity. We need to stop rubbishing our ancestors and talking about them as if they were terrible people and they weren't doing the best that they could in the situation that they were in and with the way that the times were. And we need to get back this sense that all the people that are of our ethnicity are our extended family. They are our extended kinship group, and we should be identifying with them, and we should be doing what we can for them. And then we will be able to rise back up to the top again, because at the moment, we're allied with this group that have just lost to this, this ragtag band out there in Afghanistan. I mean, just think of the shame in that. And that's what it is. It's the fact that we've lost our ethnocentrism. That's why we lost against Afghanistan more than anything else, I think.
Yeah, and one of the other things that's been recently reported as well is that when Osama bin Laden's compound was overrun in Pakistan a few years back, a letter was discovered amongst Osama bin Laden's papers, which was sent out to his acolytes around the world, warning them not to assassinate Joe Biden, but to assassinate Obama. And the reason why he didn't want Joe Biden to be assassinated was because he believed that he would form a weak and senile leader. And so he wanted Obama to be killed so that Joe Biden would, as vice president, then become the president, and felt that that would be the best thing for the Taliban. For Al Qaeda and for obviously Islamic extremism around the world. And so that's quite an interesting revelation, in my view.
And the Taliban, right, were actually enemies with Al Qaeda as well, which most people might, maybe they'll put them in the same bracket, but the Taliban are against Al Qaeda. They see Al Qaeda as a CIA sponsored organization, the same as ISIS. They see as a CIA sponsored organization that was to go in and subvert Syria. And I mean, we're Westerners, obviously. Islam doesn't suit us, but Islam does suit these other peoples where it actually came from. It does suit Arabs. It does suit these Afghans, and it's the strength of their religion and the strength of their ethnocentrism and holding true to that. That's what has caused them to defeat us. And Osama bin Laden, I mean, he was obviously right there, wasn't he, about Biden. There are calls saying that Biden is senile right now. And we can see that he mumbles his words. He forgets what he's talking about. He got asked about these people that were falling from the plane, and he said, that don't worry about that. That happened 4 or 5 days ago. And it happened the day before or something like that. I've seen him lose where he's going in the gardens of the White House, and the security guards have to call him and remind him of the way back to the path where he got lost in the bushes. I don't think he will be there for much longer. Do you, Max?
And according to a transcript of a speech that he made, which was then reported with certain parts of it deleted, he mentioned his son, and he referred to his son as having been in the Navy in Afghanistan, when in reality he'd been in the army in Iraq. As if you'd have a Navy in Afghanistan, which is a completely landlocked country. And so that was like another example of him creating a gaffe and stumbling over his words. And I mean, when he makes speeches, it's quite a sad sight in my view. And I can't see why the American people didn't realize that during the election with Trump, that Biden was such a poor quality candidate, basically, on that basis.
Yeah, and heading up the American empire, I mean, it really does show that it's just at the end times of this empire. I just hope it's not the end of the civilization as well. Of course, something we as nationalists have been warning about for some decades now. Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, we're going to be talking again about Carl Pearson, and this is our third episode on Carl Pearson. We'll start with a brief recap from last week. Last week we were talking about eugenics and how what we learn in life is not transmitted on through our genes. Although certain drives, such as the one that enables us to create civilization, looks like it does. And I say that because we've had the rise and fall of civilizations over the years. And even when we took our lowest people, the people that were our lowest classes, the criminal classes, and we sent them over to Australia, they were able to build a civilization over there. So it seems to me that white people have this ability to create civilization, and we don't actually have to be taught that. It's just something we do. We try to tame nature around us. We try to bend it to our will, and we're actually successful at doing that, whereas other peoples may be just content to live with the environment that they have around them. If you look at sort of tribes in South America and places like that, whereas white people are always looking for something more. And I think that doesn't just come from the education, that comes from something that is deep within us. And I think that is that's transmitted on, that's inheritable, whereas what we actually learn is not inheritable. And we'll learn a little bit today about how Pearson explained how civilization is produced. But is there anything else you want to add to what I was saying there, Max?
Well, Carl Pearson did mention in reference to the point you just made, he did mention about how, as far as South Africa was concerned, that the Khoisan and the Bantus had basically all of South Africa and more to themselves for several millennia, at least, probably tens of millennia, and didn't manage to provide to create a single civilization as a result of their sort of intertribal strife and constant wars with each other, etc. And as we all know, white settlers went out to South Africa, the Boers and the English and the British, I should say, and South Africa very quickly became the technological centre of all of sub-Saharan Africa, and became a nation that had, I think actually the South Africans even had their own independent nuclear deterrent as well, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They did.
So they'll be the only African country that's ever done that, and they also produced their own cars and had extensive manufacturing capability. I think they even produced their own aircraft as well, and that's in stark contrast to any of the African countries.
And it's not like they didn't educate the Africans in how to do these things, and they were able to maintain these things. But as far as innovating and continuing it doesn't look like they're having much success at that. I mean, the country is requiring food aid. It's got power cuts. The hospitals can't maintain themselves. The air force that can't maintain itself. They've had all sorts of problems over there since they've had black rule, and it's not for the want of trying from the West. I mean, the West is continually trying to help, but basically we see the proof of this, that there are differences between the races. There are differences in things that people pass on, in things that people inherit and things that people don't inherit. And until we face up to that, we're going to continue seeing these sorts of problems happening in the world, I think. Well, getting into Pearson's explanation of how civilization is produced, he said, "History shows me one way and one way only. in which a high state of civilization has been produced, namely the struggle of race with race and the survival of the physically and mentally fitter race. If you want to know whether the lower races of man can evolve a higher type, I fear the only course is to leave them to fight it out amongst themselves. And even then, the struggle for existence between individual and individual, between tribe and tribe, may not be supported by that physical selection due to a particular climate on which probably so much of the Aryan's success depended. Now, here he describes the other races as the lower races of man, and this is where this scientific racism comes in. Because why is he describing them as lower races of man? Why does he think there are higher races of man? There are just different races. And what he's talking about here are the races that you were referring to there, Max, the Khoi and the San, and other races that don't have a tradition of being able to build a civilization. And what he is wondering there is, if they were to fight amongst themselves, as we said last week, it's the act of trying to defend your nation against another that spurs on technological progress and scientific progress. We end up devoting so much money to the military. I mean, even the airplanes that we talk about now and the importance of the airport, that was set up as a defensive mechanism. So you could drop bombs from the sky. So much of our technology comes from war, which is basically the struggle between one ethnicity and another ethnicity, or one race with another race, which is what he says here. And through that struggle, you get the improvement of the technology, and you end up with civilization. What are you saying here about it may not be supported by physical selection due to a particular climate on which probably so much of the Aryan's success depended? I'm not sure there whether maybe he's thinking that Aryans only existed in the cold countries, because Aryans have existed and colonized all over the world and have done for thousands of years. So perhaps he's talking about the fact that in places like Africa, they have too much of a temperate climate. Maybe it's too easy for this to happen. What do you think he means here, Max?
Yeah, I think what he's referring to there is the fact that the emergence of anatomically modern European peoples, the Cro-Magnon people, as they're very often called, came about during the height of the last Great Ice Age, when, as far as Europe is concerned, about sort of 50% of Europe was covered under an ice sheet that was about 2 miles thick, and where there was the most inhospitable climate raging throughout the southern parts of Europe, and there is a fairly general belief amongst anthropologists, and there has been really since the early part of the last century, the belief that those really harsh conditions created the evolutionary pressure that resulted in increased intelligence and increased innovation, amongst Europeans, and because effectively people were forced into learning how to make clothing, because if you couldn't make clothing, then you would just freeze to death. People had to learn to memorize the seasons, because unless they could memorize the seasons, they wouldn't know where the reindeer were going to be at a certain time in a year, so they wouldn't know where to go to hunt them. They wouldn't know where the bison were going to be. They wouldn't know where the mammoths were going to be. And of course, they needed to know where these creatures were at particular times of the year, so that they could hunt them in order to feed their families, so they didn't starve to death. And so it was forced upon the peoples of Europe in those days to have in their head, to carry in their head a memory of the years that have gone by, and a memory of the land over which they travelled. And there's evidence that they very often had to travel over vast expanses of the tundra that existed in order to locate their prey animals. And so they would have to be able to remember the landscape, so that they could recognize where they were, and as I say, they would have to be able to remember what time of year, and so that forced them to create a calendar, for example. And so, and there have been some bone bone artifacts that have been found that have got cuts in them, which archaeologists believe represent the sort of ticking off of days, or the sort of charting of days in nicks along the side of the bone, so that they would be able to keep track of where they were in any particular month of the year or any particular season. And so and there are rudimentary letters that have been found carved into some bones in some of the Cro-Magnon encampments that have been excavated in the southern parts of Russia, where there are what are regarded as alphabeti forms. They're not quite the letters that we use in our alphabet, but they are symbols that are obviously strung together to create some kind of a message or to record something. Not the, the symbols that we use today for our alphabet, or the symbols that we use today for our system of numeracy, but symbols nonetheless that which can only have been used in order to record something.
I tend to take the opposite view there. I tend to think that we had to have a certain proficiency before you could even go into places like the tundra. You know, we had to have technological advancement. We had to understand about navigation. We had to understand about clothing. We had to understand about fire. We had to have metalworking. And I think we did all of that in the Fertile Crescent, where the first civilization sprung up. And then we headed off looking for resources, particularly tin, and the largest deposit of tin was in Cornwall, and we had to have had that tin from Cornwall to take it to the Fertile Crescent for the Bronze Age to take off in the Fertile Crescent. So I tend to believe that we had to have a certain standard before we could end up going into these cold countries. And with the rate of population replacement that we see now, for instance, if you just think in the last 70 years, 20% of the people that already live here have been replaced by another people, and within another 40 years it's going to be 60% of the population here now will have been replaced by another people. So within 100 years the majority of the people that will be here will be a different people to the people that were here 100 years ago. So when they find evidence of things like antlers with what appears to be writing on them, there's nothing to say they were our ancestors. They were probably the people that were here in Europe before we came here, because there are population movements all the time. And you think about it, you move to a new area, you dig into the ground there and you find a body. It's not going to be one of your familial ancestors, is it? Because you've only just moved into the area. And as you said, Max, we're moving about all the time, you know, moving across the tundra. So I tend to take the opposite view, but go on.
Well, the ice sheets weren't a static thing, you see. The ice sheets advanced and retreated all the time, just as they do today. And during periods when the ice sheets retreated, that then created a slightly warmer climate, which would then enable European, the Proto-Europeans to advance into Europe. And then as the ice sheets advanced again, then they would be forced back out again. But the climate in the Middle East, and you're referring to the Fertile Crescent, during the height of the last ice age, the climate there was a cool temperate climate with fir trees and bears and wild boar, all the same sort of animals that you would find in Northern Europe today. So effectively what you had was just a period, an extended period, where the climatic zones that exist across the Arctic and Northern Europe and Northern Asia today just migrated south as the ice sheets advanced, and then retreated north again. And the warmer climates, so there would have been some interaction, I'm sure, between the people who were living in the cool temperate parts and the people who were living on the tundra. And there would have been some interaction between the people who lived in the in the warmer parts, as well as those that with those that were living in the cool temperate parts. So, and it would have all been as a result of the constant advance and then retreat of the ice sheets. And so, I wouldn't say that what I said is wrong. What I would say is that some of what you have said would be true as well. That if our ancestors had exited Africa, for example, and had just gone naked into frozen tundra, then of course they wouldn't have survived, they would have died. But if they were living on in a cool temperate area where there was cold, snowy winters, then yes, they would have learned to make clothes. They wouldn't necessarily have just died out straight away. And from the point of view of knowing whether these people are our ancestors or not, then there is a genetic the genome for Cro-Magnon specimens have established that they are predominantly in a very, very similar genetic type to modern day Europeans, and the genetic sequencing of modern day people have shown that there is still some Neanderthal DNA within the European peoples of today as well. So it wasn't so much a matter of the people that were first to meet the ice sheets being completely eliminated. It's just that they became a smaller and smaller percentage of the population and eventually became absorbed into the population, which would have been directly ancestral to us.
Well, they like to say that, but I don't think there's actually any concrete proof that just because we have a certain section of our DNA in modern humans today, that another group of humans also have in their DNA. It doesn't mean necessarily that we got it from them. I mean, all DNA is made up of the same letters, isn't it? G, I forget what the letters are, but they're all made up of a similar bit of code that is put together. It's the same letters that go together. So I'm not so certain it's inherited. And though the Cro-Magnons may have been similar to what man is today, it wasn't the same. And we know that blacks in particular, they have a very different DNA that they say that they inherited from one of these groups that were there before that white people don't have. I tend to think that the humans today are, or white people today in particular, are a unique type. And you can compare it to cars. I mean, cars use the same nuts and bolts and wheels and the same structure, but they're all different, and they didn't evolve one from another just because one car has the same system. It has nuts and bolts and the rest of it. It doesn't mean that another car evolved from it. It's just that's the pattern for all life. It's interesting we have these disagreements here, Max. Both have our different theories here. And obviously Pearson was, he leaned towards what you were saying here. So you've explained what he said here about the climate. He was also known in his lifetime as a prominent free thinker and a socialist. Free thinkers hold that knowledge should be grounded in facts, scientific inquiry and logic. The skeptical application of science implies freedom from the intellectually limiting effects of confirmation bias, cognitive bias, conventional wisdom, popular culture, urban myth, prejudice, or sectarianism. And I would say we try to be like that. We try not to have this confirmation bias, cognitive bias, urban myth, prejudice. You know, we try to look at the facts and the statistics, and we look at the pattern recognition, but so much of that is now considered to be politically incorrect or considered to be taboo, particularly the sort of stuff that Pearson was interested in. He also gave lectures on such issues as the women's question, this being the era of the suffragist movement in the UK, and also upon Karl Marx. So he was very interested in socialism, and his commitment to socialism and its ideals actually led him to refuse the offer of being created an OBE, an Officer of the Order of the British Empire, in 1920, and also to refuse a knighthood in 1935. I do find it interesting that people today, they think that they're free thinkers. And yet when you look here and see what a free thinker actually is, most people today are not free thinkers. They're blinkered thinkers because of this political correctness that we have to go along with all the time. What do you think of these subjects here, Max?
Well, quite a lot of the publications that you can find if you scour the internet the legacy of Karl Pearson, which are very often transcripts of speeches that he made. What you find there is that he very often made speeches to audiences of people who wouldn't necessarily have agreed with what he was saying. And one such speech was one that was made in 1912. It was called the Cavendish Lecture. I don't know whether they still hold the Cavendish Lectures, but they had been held for something like 30 years or so prior to 1912, when Pearson spoke. And the speech he made is entitled Darwinism, Medical Progress and Eugenics, where he spelled out his version of how eugenics should work, and pointed to various maladies that people suffered from in those times, and pointed to the fact that because the audience was made up primarily of medical men who would have been involved in alleviating the distress caused by these maladies, but who wouldn't necessarily have been conducting the statistical analysis or conducting these kind of investigations that were necessary to identify the fact that lots of these maladies were genetically determined and were heritable characteristics, and that a lot of these maladies, if a eugenic program was implemented, could be eliminated. And one of the mistakes that people very often make when they consider eugenics is they think that eugenics automatically involves the sterilization of people that have got any kind of sort of genetic malady, or the in extreme cases the murdering of people that have got genetic maladies so that they can't reproduce and so that they won't exist within society. Carl Pearson didn't hold that point of view. He believed that people that had genetic maladies should still reproduce, but that they should limit themselves to a single child. And this is making a speech about eugenics some years back where I made exactly the same point, which is that if you decide that you're going to sterilize people that have got genetic maladies, or if you're going to, in extreme cases, kill them so that they can't reproduce, the point is that you're putting them in a situation where they've got no vested interest in the posterity of society. And if they have no interest in the posterity of society, if they're never going to have any children, then why should they care about the condition of their fellow men, fellow men and women? Why should they care at all? And therefore there is no ownership of the eugenic policy on their part. But if you can show that through eugenics and through them limiting the number of children that they have, that it will create a process during which the numbers of people in society that will suffer from that particular malady will gradually reduce, generation after generation, it will reduce and reduce and reduce, and then eventually be eliminated. And that the children that they have, or the child that they have, will pass on their good genes into, albeit that they may have some genes that cause the genetic malady, but they will also be passing on their good genes. And eventually it will only be the genes that cause the genetic malady that will be eliminated. And the good genes that those people possess will go on and will be part of our posterity. And so by having that more enlightened approach to eugenics, you can sell the idea to people on the basis of their own genetic self-interest, and they will see that their children will be part of the posterity and will be better off as a result of them limiting the number of children that they have. And so it is a humane and far more acceptable version of eugenics. And it's interesting that as far back as 1912, Carl Pearson was saying this, and yet still, whenever the term eugenics is broached, you get people screaming, people from the left, liberals screaming about how it will all end up in gas chambers. Well, it doesn't have to, and it doesn't need to. And Carl Pearson was a socialist, but he was a national socialist back in 1912. And his version of eugenics didn't involve any harm coming to anybody whatsoever.
That's far more humane than offering rewards for sterilizing people, isn't it? I mean, you can say, well, that's humane. You're offering a reward, but there's still going to be sterilized, and they're still then not going to have a stake in society. Whereas if they just have the one child, obviously you get less and less of these people that have these genetic problems. And that the whole point of it was to be benevolent to people, so that people had a right to be born into a healthy body with a healthy mind. And obviously things have got better since then with medicine. They probably had a lot more people that were born with these genetic deformities back then, but the whole point of eugenics was to improve the health of the nation, to look at the nation as a whole rather than just looking at the individuals and the individual's needs, but to look at everybody's needs and to try and raise up the conditions so that everybody was more healthy and didn't pass on, you know, these genetic problems. Yeah, I hadn't heard that one before. Obviously, I'd heard of positive eugenics, where you offer the rewards, and negative eugenics, when you force people to do things. I guess that would be benevolent eugenics, maybe, or sympathetic eugenics. Can you think of a word for that? Is there a word to describe that particular type of it?
I would think benevolent eugenics would be a suitable title for that approach.
Well, next we have Pearson's views on the Jews. In The Myth of the Jewish Race, Raphael and Jennifer Pate cite Carl Pearson's 1925 opposition, which was in the first issue of the journal Annals of Eugenics, which he founded, his opposition to Jewish immigration into Britain. Pearson alleged that these immigrants will develop into a parasitic race, and he says that taken on the average and regarding both sexes, this alien Jewish population is somewhat inferior physically and mentally to the native population. And I think there are three interesting things here. Number one, it shows that this was the sort of thing that could be talked about at the time. You could describe another race and say, well, wouldn't they be a bit parasitic if they were to come into our nation? Something that you would definitely have problems with saying today, unless it was very, very carefully contextualized. Secondly, he talks about this alien Jewish population being somewhat inferior physically. And I did a podcast the other week about a Jewish author who was talking about how Jews have managed to succeed in America with gaining influence over the last 100 years. And he made this point himself, that Jews were inferior or are inferior physically to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And they felt that they had to compete with Anglo-Saxon Protestants in a different way. So what he is saying here is actually borne out by Jews today. And thirdly, where he says that they would be inferior mentally to the native population. Now, I don't believe that's true, because with the IQ test, they show that Ashkenazi Jews, there's a particular subset of Ashkenazi Jews that have the highest IQ of all. And Jews are well known for being very intelligent. So where was he getting this idea from, that Jews were mentally inferior to the population? So just three thoughts there on this. What are your thoughts on what he has to say here, Max?
I think using the term parasitic race is the wrong thing to do. I think that one of the things that I've done on Western Spring over the time that we've had our website up, and I've been publishing articles, is to float the idea, and pretty much I've proven that this is a social trend, a social dynamic of what I describe as organized minority advantage. And what you find whenever there is a minority group that migrates into a country where there is an identifiably separate host community, is that minority group will tend to socialize more with their own people, and will tend to work more closely together with their own people, and will adopt an in-group and out-group approach to all of their dealings with other people, where they have where they regard themselves as being an identifiable in-group, where they give preference to people of their own ethnicity, and where they don't offer the same terms. They don't operate in the same way with the host community that they regard as being the out-group. And this happens almost invariably wherever there are minority groups that go. There's an article that I've written, which is called Paradise Island, the Parable. And if people would like to read that, it explains there's a fair bit of maths involved in the article. So it's not for the faint hearted. But if anybody wants to understand the mechanism by which an organized minority can become disproportionately wealthy at the expense of a host community, that's that they should read that article, because it sets it all out there with in a way which nobody can actually disagree with. And I think that what's happened with regard to Jewish immigration into Western Europe and to Britain during the early part of the 20th century was that a lot of the Jews concerned came from Eastern Europe, which was racked with all sorts of diseases like TB. And so from that point of view, I think it was identified that a higher proportion of Jewish immigrants into London during the early part of the 20th century had TB compared to the general population. In terms of the mental aspects of things, it has been a principle, I believe, within Jewish societies for men to marry their daughters to rabbis, and rabbis generally have tended to be the most academically able amongst the Jewish community, which is why they have become a rabbi, a teacher. And there has been a tendency over many hundreds of years for wealthy Jews that have become rich as a result of their business dealings to marry their daughters off to rabbis. And so they've had their own eugenic program, which has been orientated around increasing the intelligence of the leadership core within Jewish communities across Europe, that's been very beneficial from the point of view of creating a higher average IQ, I believe, for Jews generally. The price that you pay for that is that there was a certain amount of inbreeding that took place in order to achieve that, and that's part of the reason why I think Jewish communities suffer more from Asperger's syndrome than the population at large. And there are a lot of the doctors who specialize in treating Asperger's syndrome are Jews. And it is a result of the fact that they can see there is a very large amount of Asperger's syndrome in their community. And if you look at select groups European peoples generally, groups that are selected on the basis of their intelligence, what you find is that there is a high level of Asperger's syndrome. If you look at Mensa, which is the Society for Very Intelligent People that exists in this country and also in many other European countries across the world, what you find in Mensa is that the Mensa as an organization exists to be effectively a social club for people who have got very high intelligence, but who also suffer from Asperger's syndrome, which means that they find it very difficult to socialise and to meet partners and to progress in a social sense. Those people who have got very high intelligence and who don't have a problem socialising with other people, they don't need to join Mensa, and so Mensa is effectively a select group of people who, as I say, have got high intelligence, but who've paid quite a heavy price for it in terms of the sense that they've got Asperger's syndrome. And I would suspect that the same factor is at play with regard to Jewish groups, where they have perhaps interbred to too great an extent in order to advance their average intelligence through selective breeding.
So you might get a inferior physique, but a higher intelligence, and you would imagine a small minority would be selecting for intelligence because that is what they would need, whereas a larger group or the host nation would be selecting for physique, so they would end up with a better physique and not so brightly intelligent. I wouldn't describe Jews as a parasitic race at all. I would say that they understand that there is a competition between the races and they are just competing to do the best for their people. I certainly wouldn't describe them as being parasitic. I know authors have done in the past, but I think when you look at it as a competition that's going on, a struggle between different extended kinship groups to advance their cause, and then you can see that there are different ways that these groups advance their cause, and it becomes quite fascinating, actually, the real differences between the races and between the ethnicities, and how over time they have managed to gain influence or managed to progress. And Jews are experts at doing that within multicultural countries because that's what they've been used to, and we are not used to that. We're used to having monocultural countries, so Jews are doing particularly well at the moment. So it's a shame that he described them as a parasitic race. I doubt very much whether he saw himself as being anti-Semitic. I should imagine he was just using this this analogy there in a scientific way.
But if you look at 19th century India, what you've got there is a very small British minority ruling over a vast swathe of people of the Indian subcontinent. And the part of the reason for them being able to do that was military. But part of the reason also was because there was an in-group, out-group attitude that was employed by the British settlers that went out there. That was then copied by Indians who went to South Africa and other African countries like Uganda, where they set up in business and they practiced their own in-group, out-group policy there, and to such a point where Idi Amin became enraged about the fact that there were so many successful Indian business people in Uganda, and that they were appeared to him to be enriching themselves at the expense of the Ugandan people. And so he then expelled the Indians from Uganda, and then we've got the same situation where the Ugandan refugees, lots of them came to Britain, and again, I think as far as the Indian community is concerned, just like any minority group in any country, practiced in-group, out-group preference. And so now we have a number of very successful Indian families in Britain as well. And so rather than trying to claim that any one particular ethnic group or race is particularly bad or evil or parasitic, to use those kind of emotive terms, rather than do that, we should just recognize that all human groups practice in-group, out-group preference. And if we don't like being the victim of the in-group, out-group preference practiced by the immigrant groups that come to Britain, then we need to start practicing an in-group, out-group approach to our dealings with them. And that would then level the playing field.
Definitely need to start practicing more in-group preference and more positive ethnocentrism. Interesting you bring up the Indians there in Uganda, because a similar thing happened with the uprisings in South Africa just recently. They started going after the Indian groups as well. I mean, it's just a natural thing. If you're a minority living amongst a host nation, is you're going to work and you're going to network within your minority, and you're going to keep the money within that group. You're going to go to businesses that are owned by that group. You're going to share the money and loan out money to gain influence. And that's what has happened. We have all these different groups within society now that have got influence, and we've been left behind as white people. We've been resting on our laurels. You know, we thought it was going to be easy. We were going to have our monocultural societies forever, and we don't have a monocultural society anymore. We have a multicultural society, and we've lost our way. We have forgotten that we're in the middle of this competition. These other groups understand it. They understand it very well. We seem to have forgotten, though. Well, I think we should leave that there for this week, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
That's right. It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks on Monday with more of Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.